Perfect. Well, welcome, and thank you for coming to week two of Jew of the Future. Our topic this morning, be fruitful, screen, and multiply. Before we get to that, first of all, a reminder to please silence cell phones. It's a lot better if you silence it now as opposed to if it rings in a few minutes. In the event that you received the email with the source sheet for this class in advance, that means you are on the email list for this class. If you didn't get it, please see me afterwards and give me your email address. I will add you that way to the list, and that way you will receive the follow-up after the class with a link to the audio recording. You get the sheets in advance, and you will get notification for the Wednesday classes at Beth Emeth when they restart in the fall. I've actually started to come up with the list and the dates and so forth. I'm hoping to have a two-parter in the month of September, leading into Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And then we should have a lot of fun in the coming year. I think the topics are going to be good. Once I have more information, I'll let you know. A reminder for those who have heard it but forgot, or those or new information for those who are new. There are washrooms in this hallway. Women's washrooms on this side, men's on this side. There is one here that's handicapped accessible. I know everything was unlocked in time this week. I'm grateful to Dan Valter for helping with that. And as I said last week, there is nothing I can do about the air conditioning. So if it's too hot for you, if it's too cold for you, it's the way it is. And if it's perfect, that's an accident. Okay. So in order to discuss the topic for today, in order to talk about genetic screening, which is really the essence of our topic, we need to talk about a process called IVF, in vitro fertilization, as well as PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. If I could ask people to just avoid sitting behind me. You can be on the side, that's great, but don't be behind me because that gets confusing. So, historically, before the advent of IVF, before the advent of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, if men and women had a concern that when they got married, they might be carrying some kind of genetic disease, and marrying each other and producing children could lead, in fact, to a child who would have a disorder. Tay-Sachs is one example of it, but there are unfortunately many, many more. The option that they had was to get genetic testing and to see, are they both carriers? In the event that they are both carriers, that does not guarantee the child is going to get the disease. It depends on whether we're talking about a recessive gene or a dominant gene. It depends on whether they are both carriers. Only one of them is a carrier. It depends on whether the child is a male or a female. We're not going to get hugely into the genetics. Some of it may come into play in a little bit. But the bottom line is that the only way you could ascertain that the child was not going to carry this disease or was not going to manifest the disease was by testing the genes of the couple. And they could test before they get married and then decide should they go ahead and get married, or if they're already married, they can then do the test at that point and decide whether they want to produce children. And that was what was done for a while. There was some controversy about it within the Jewish world. Not everybody was a fan of this. I remember when I got married, which was in 1997, there were people who were saying, well, should you really get tested? At that point, testing, though, was fairly popular, certainly for certain diseases. It was really back in the 70s that this was a much more fraught debate, the 70s and the early 80s. Why would there have been opposition to that sort of testing? Sorry? You're supposed to procreate, but you can decide to procreate with this person. You can decide to marry somebody else.
Could it be harmful at all?
No danger. No danger. Yeah.
Well, you don't want to anticipate God.
Don't want to anticipate God? We're going to come back to that? Yeah.
They probably didn't want to have an abortion.
I'm talking about before they get married, and I'm working with the assumption that before they get married, nothing else is going on. Diane.
No, I was going to say they don't want to play God.
Right, so anticipating God, playing God. If you take a look at source number one on your sheet, you find a very important Talmudic story, which we're going to come back to, I expect, in week four, because it's going to matter a lot when we discuss predictive algorithms. I only brought you a brief excerpt from what is a longer story. As the story is told in Tanakh, there was a king by the name of Chizkiyahu. He was a righteous king, king of Judea, the southern kingdom, when the Jews had split between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom during the time of the first temple. Chizkiyahu was one of the better kings who we had. And at one point, the prophet Yeshaya, Isaiah, comes to him and says to him, I have bad news. Look after the affairs of your household, because it's over. And Chizkiyahu wants to do something about it. He wants to challenge, he wants to pray, whatever it is. And Isaiah gives him the following explanation for what he has done wrong. If you take a look at source number one, Isaiah replied, it is because you have not been involved in procreation. The answer is, you didn't try to have children. Now, there's much more to this story than we're going to talk about right now. I'm only borrowing this story right now. We may discuss it more in week four. But he says to him, you didn't even try. To which Chizkiyahu, Hezekiah, says, well, there was a reason I didn't try. I had a vision that I was going to have bad children. And so therefore I said, you know what? I don't want to have children. Now, this isn't random person saying that. Because what is going to be the first name of Chizkiyahu's son if he has a son?
King.
Correct. The first name of his son is going to be King. And he says, I don't want to put a bad king on the throne of the Jewish people. And therefore, I didn't pursue having children. To which Isaiah replied, it's in the Aramaic, it's Bahadei Kavshei Derachmana Lamalach. What business do you have in the secrets of the Merciful One of God? You have a mitzvah. Your mitzvah is go out, have a family, bear fruit, multiply. Not everybody can succeed. That's true. Sometimes people need to adopt if they're going to raise children. Sometimes people aren't going to have either way. But it's not your business to decide, I'm abstaining. Now, as it happens, in terms of this story, anybody know the name of Chizkiyahu's eventual son? Because he did have one?
Menashe.
Menashe, correct. Because Chizkiyahu's son was Menashe. Menashe, in fact, becomes king, and he spends his first 22 years on the throne trying to get Jews to worship idols, destroying Torah scrolls, and so on. He is a disaster. As Tanakh, as scripture describes it, the blood in Jerusalem runs from one end of Jerusalem to the other. In his day, there's such bloodshed. And then, after that, he reforms. He tries to go straight, and he spends the next 33 years trying to correct the wrongs he's committed. But the point of this story, and the reason I bring it here, is because of the message of, don't play God. Who are you to decide that you shouldn't pursue having children? So that's that's one argument that was brought against screening. The truth of the matter is, there's a lot to discuss about that aspect of the screening issue, but I'm holding that for week four because there's so many other things to discuss now. It really deserves its own discussion. The playing God concern has to have its own time. There are other reasons why people oppose it. A prediction of genetic disease can lead to a sweeping decision not to marry at all, or not to have children, when in fact they could have succeeded, perhaps with a different partner, if they do this before they get married. There are ways that they could deal with it. There are concerns about potentially causing a stigma for the family as a whole. And now siblings won't be able to get married if word gets out. So there were all sorts of rules that were set up within the Orthodox community when testing first started about who would be notified and how they would be notified. So one popular system at the time, it's still actually in use, was to say, people should actually get tested before they're even dating, or at the start of their dating career. And they get a serial number. And then at the time when either they want to start going out with somebody, or when they're closer to getting married, let them both send in their number to the agency that did the testing, and the agency will simply respond saying, carrier, not carrier, but like good match or problem in terms of a particular disorder or whatever, and that way they don't even know who did it, you know, who it's for. I'm going to leave aside that piece of this because, again, there's so much more that we need to talk about in terms of screening than just the question of playing God. But just to note that even that was controversial. And that was basically your way to avoid having a child with a particular disorder for a long time. Until recent years. And now we have instead the advantage of the pairing of IVF, in vitro fertilization, and PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. I keep on spelling that out, not because I think you forgot what it was, but because I'm proud of myself for remembering what it is. So at some point I will go back to just saying PGD instead of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, but it took me long enough to learn it, and I'm going to get my mileage out of it. So, advances in molecular biology allow men and women to use IVF to produce a pre-embryo in a laboratory and then examine it to see whether, in fact, it is carrying genes for particular diseases. That's remarkable. Because now, even if you have a couple who are carriers for a disease, they are able to produce pre-embryos in the lab and have them tested. So let's say they produce six. I'm making up a number. But let's say they produce six pre-embryos. They have them tested. Turns out, in fact, two of them would have been carriers for Tay-Sachs or would have had Tay-Sachs themselves. But four of them are not. They can then choose to implant some of the four into the uterus and carry those and have no risk of this genetic disorder. And that way you avoid the problem. And that's, in a nutshell, the attempt with IVF and PGD. Are we clear? You're testing the pre-embryo before implanting it in the uterus. And this exists. Like, this is current technology. Use of IVF is a little bit controversial in its own right in Jewish law. Leave aside the PGD piece of it. But the idea of taking sperm from a man and an egg from a woman and actually creating the embryo, pre-embryo, in the lab is in and of itself somewhat controversial. Not all rabbis have approved it, and even today it doesn't have across-the-board approval. What could be wrong? Now, this one actually is not a playing God opposition because it's considered a technology like any other that we've developed using God-given brains. If it doesn't violate a particular law, there's no opposition on the playing God front. Diane?
One, you're wasting sperm. You're disposing of sperm.
Right.
What do you do with the viable eggs that you don't use?
Right. So two of the concerns are what Diane just mentioned. One concern is the way in which this seed is produced and the fact that not all of it is going to lead to a viable child leads some to argue that this is a wasting of potential life in that sense. And coupled with that is the concern I just mentioned, you may produce six embryos and only implant whatever you're going to implant. One, two, I mean, how many are you really going to implant? And the rest of them, there is an option sometimes of freezing them, and then someone could later use them. Sometimes they may be used for research, and sometimes they're going to get thrown out. And this is a potential life. Now, Judaism is not the Catholic Church in the sense of believing that from the moment of conception it is now considered murder to destroy them. We're going to come back to how Judaism does view it, but that's part of the opposition. Sandy, you were going to say. That's okay, I'm going to repeat it.
If you select the embryos that are viable, that are not diseased, or potentially diseased, what do you, if you dispose of the ones that are not good, then that could potentially be looked at as murder.
Right. So again, the issue of what are you doing when you dispose of the ones you're not going to implant. Correct. There are a couple of other concerns. You know, I'm just looking at the time, and I'm going to go a little bit further with it. The one of the classic concerns, which is less of a concern today than it was historically, is that fear of lab mix-ups can create problems. Right? You've all seen the headline cases in which parents who children produced through IVF find out that actually there was a mix-up. Somebody else was the father. There have been cases as well of intentional abuses of the system that have come up. So that is a potential concern. You can't get around that. This is a problem in its own right. Nowadays, you have the option of a system of hashgacha, of supervision, meaning that in Israel, this is what's done. But I even had this recommended from someone who headed a fertility clinic here in town, who came to a lecture that I taught on genetic screening, and he actually said to me, these things still go on, and it would be wise to have somebody supervising and making sure that the right samples are being used. Another concern that comes up is that the mother needs to take hormones in order to be able to produce the egg that they're actually going to use for IVF. So while the risk is low, nonetheless, anytime you're talking about tampering hormonally, there are always concerns about the impact that may be involved, as well as the procedure to remove the eggs. That's also a procedure, and all procedures involve risk. Whether it's just the basic risk of infection or something else, all procedures involve risk. And so, for all of these reasons, there has been opposition to IVF, but now let's switch over to the PGD issues. Right? The issues involved in testing this child. Number one, you're going to require, with this procedure, some form of birth control. I know it sounds funny when we're talking about producing a child, but actually some form of birth control will be required. Because otherwise you run into the risk that even as she produced an egg that they're going to use for this, right? He produced seed and now they're growing something in a lab and they want to implant it, she may become pregnant in the interim. Right? And that wrecks your entire procedure. So you'll have the question of birth control. But that's number one. Number two, you have the philosophical problem. What's the philosophical problem in using PGD to screen an embryo? Sorry? Well, not so much the playing God that Marilyn notes, but along those lines, Elaine?
You're sort of making a decision to discard the potential child you already know will have health concerns and developmental concerns, which is really questionable.
Right. There are serious ethical challenges in this sort of process. Right? I mean, it's one thing to say the baby is going to have Tay-Sachs, where, unfortunately, current state of medical technology, we can't do much. But what about when you veer from Tay-Sachs to conditions that are not necessarily fatal? Conditions that may be developmental, right? And I'm specifically not mentioning anything in particular because I don't want to get into particular cases and sensitivities. But what if you have a case in which somebody says, I want to use PGD to screen for something which they consider significant and they are now going to destroy embryos because they don't have this particular trait that I value, but that society as a whole does not consider to be worthy of discarding an embryo for it. Let's say they say, I don't want my child to be bald. You laugh, but I'll give you a case. I mentioned last week, and I'm going to quote him later on, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, pediatric neurologist in Shaare Tzedek Hospital in Israel, leading authority on Jewish medical ethics today. So the case that I heard him give involving baldness was a child that we're going to have a boy in the Hasidic community. And all the kids run around with long payas, and this child is going to be in preschool, kindergarten, with all the other kids, and is going to be bald. We're not talking about going bald, you know, 40s, 50s, whatever. We're talking about as a child. And what? How is that going to affect this child growing up with peers who, you know, like kids all over the place, are going to be brutal, because that's what kids do. So if they can screen for that, maybe there is a justification. You know, it's though we laugh when someone says screening for baldness, but the truth of the matter is, you never know. You have to get the details of the situation, Pearlie.
But you just pointed out that we're not the Catholic Church.
Yep.
And so what you're talking about are things that in the future would happen if this becomes a child. But at the point at which you're talking, it is not a child.
Right.
It's not a person.
Right. No, that's the question I want to come back to. But the issue is that when you screen for particular traits, and when you decide an embryo with this trait is not something to be implanted, brought to term, you run the risk of dehumanizing people. I don't want a child who has that. And I am willing to say, if I have to choose which embryo to save, I'm going to save this one, and I'm not going to save that one. The ramifications of that for society are immense, right? There are questions about gender balance. What happens if people say, I want to have a certain gender? We are familiar with certain cultures in which there's such an emphasis on males that, forget PGD, talk about abortion. They create an imbalance at ratios of 130 to 100 male to female in certain communities because of their choice of a particular gender. There are all sorts of circumstances that you can create here. Yes.
Pardon. I am the grandfather of 6 frozen embryos. We have a wonderful grandson, and when my son was deciding to be a second child, this is a very important issue. He's got a son who would like to do it. Like, can you also test?
I'm going to repeat, don't worry.
I haven't heard of people. The normal way of becoming pregnant, I haven't heard of such people testing themselves, producing several embryos, and can you test one who's taller, who's got what's his IQ, what's your IQ?
Right. So the question, the issue of, and the question that was raised was, how far are people actually going with PGD? The answer is, they are going as far as the law will allow them to go. That's really where things are. So, for example, we're going to talk about choosing for gender, which was the case that you mentioned. But if you flip the sheet for a second to the other side, to source number 14. This is about policy in the United States. Unlike many European nations, the USA has no regulation concerning the use of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, a technique employed during some fertility treatments to select embryos based on their genes. As such, PGD can and is used for a variety of controversial purposes, including sex selection, so you could choose the gender of your child on this basis, selection for children with disabilities such as deafness, meaning choosing those who have it, not talking about choosing not to, where parents specifically want it, and selection for savior siblings who can serve as tissue donors for sick relatives. The lack of regulation, which is due to particular features of the U.S. political and economic landscape, has ethical and practical implications for patients seeking PGD around the world. Because what you end up with is a version of medical tourism, right? Well, people will go there in order to be able to do it. Now, everyone then asks, well, what about Canada? Take a look at source number 15, the Assisted Human Reproduction Act, enacted in 2004, but still the law on the books today, lists no person shall knowingly do a bunch of things, and one of them is, for the purpose of creating a human being, perform any procedure or provide, prescribe, or administer anything that would ensure or increase the probability that an embryo will be of a particular sex or that would identify the sex of an in vitro embryo except to prevent, diagnose, or treat a sex-linked disorder or disease, which we'll talk about later. Leaving aside the last clause, it is illegal in Canada to do it in order to choose gender. What's happening there? I don't know, but that's the current state of things in terms of Canadian law. So the concern is there. The concern is there about this. Now, to go back to the question of, is it abortion? Or to say it differently, not is it abortion? Is it acceptable within Judaism to abort a pre-embryo because it doesn't have the, because it has a disease, or because it isn't the gender you want, or whatever else? I gave you a link on the sheet back on the first side to classes that I've taught on abortion. The first link is one that I gave to physicians a while back, and then the other two are actually from a series we had on medical ethics back in November. So we did abortion as a topic then. There was a part one and a part two, so you can click on those links and you'll be able to get it. Again, those who got the sheets in advance by email can click on it. Those who are working from this would have to retype it, but those are available. But basically what we said was, there is a range of opinion in Jewish law about what one is doing when one aborts a pre-embryo. I use the word abort because that's what it is, not in order to judge it as murder or not murder. It's just a technical term. If you take a look at source number 3, one position, that of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. He is talking in this context about a fetus, not necessarily the pre-embryo. Remember, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein passed away in 1986. He never saw PGD. But he says, regarding aborting a fetus, he says, the text in the Rambam, in Maimonides, based on the Talmud, about killing a fetus in general. Let me state it outside before we see what he says. It'll be easier this way. The Talmud speaks about a case in which a woman is trying to give birth, and the act itself is dangerous to her life. So the fetus poses a threat to the life of the mother, and it says we choose the mother's life first. Even if that means that we have to kill the fetus in order to save the life of the mother, that's what Jewish law would prescribe. That's the Talmudic case. However, when Maimonides quotes it, and when the Talmud even says it, it says, and the statement is, you're allowed to do this because it is killing the mother. The implication of that, which Rabbi Feinstein notes, is that otherwise I wouldn't be allowed to do this. The only justification is it's a threat to the mother's life. So he says, if the only justification for ending the life of the fetus is where it is itself a threat to the mother's life, that must mean that killing a fetus is considered like killing a human being. And in the same way that I'm allowed to kill a human being who is a threat to another human being, if I see somebody trying to kill somebody else, I indeed am allowed to kill the assailant in order to save his intended victim. So too here, I'm allowed to kill the fetus to save the fetus's mother. That was Rabbi Feinstein's position. Right? Feinstein's stance was that the fetus is a full life and killing the fetus is murder. Not everybody agreed. If you take a look at source number 4, Rabbi Yosef ben Moshe Trani disagreed and quoted from Tosafot, a collection of comments going back to the 13th century, who said that abortion is actually considered an act of wounding. It's not an act of murder, it's an act of wounding. And this may be seen biblically, because, and for those who were there at Beth Emeth in November, who I'm sure remember all the details of the class, this is going to be a little boring. But for everybody else, the Torah text speaks about the following horrible case. There are two men who get in a fight. One of them is trying to hit the other one, and accidentally strikes a pregnant woman. And she loses the pregnancy. So the rule is, you have to pay for damages. If killing a fetus were really considered to be murder, there would be no payment, there would be a death penalty. The fact that the Torah says that you pay damages suggests that it's viewed as an act of wounding, it's not considered an act of murder. And that's the basis for what you see in source number 4, it's an act of wounding. Now, of course, within that you have to ask a question. Who is being wounded here? The mother or the fetus? Right? Is it wounding the mother or is it wounding the fetus? This matters a lot for our conversation. Because in the event that the embryo has not been implanted yet, and you call abortion an act of wounding, but wounding the mother, there's no wound to the mother. You haven't done anything to her body at all. She's in the next room. She could be at home. So it's only a concern if it's about wounding the fetus. So it matters. There are two different ways to frame that. But there's another view. The next view I bring you here in number 5 is Rabbi Yair Bachrach. And he says, it's not an issue of murder, and it's not an issue of wounding at all. Rather, it's an issue of destroying seed, destroying potential life. Because had this gone to term, it would in fact have led to a full-blown life. Now it won't. You have cut short the capacity for life. We don't destroy things if we can avoid it. But clearly that is a lower level concern than murder, and it's even a lower level concern than wounding. You start to see the scale. Just a second, Susan. And then finally, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, writing in number 6, notes, you have a bunch of other ethical norms in Judaism which should not be overlooked. He says, what about V'asita ha'yashar v'atov? You shall do that which is upright and good. Kedoshim to you, you shall be holy. V'alachta bidrachav, you shall follow in the ways of God. We have all sorts of ethical imperatives. Don't be so quick to abort. We have these concerns as well. So you have a hierarchy of concerns regarding abortion. I'm obviously oversimplifying. This is a much bigger topic. But my point is that depending on how you understand what abortion is of a pre-embryo, that will determine when we consider abortion to be justified. If you're going to tell me that it's murder, you need a very heavy justification for that. If you're going to tell me that it's wounding, you need a lesser justification. If you're going to tell me that it's simply wasting the opportunity for life, then you need a lower level justification in order to make it not an act of wasting. So this is going to matter when we talk about what justifies screening in PGD. Are we clear on what I just set out here? Okay, Susan.
But isn't there a difference between the embryo and the fetus? What if an embryo, it's still not been fertilized? And you're saying a woman in the embryo is in the other room when we were talking. So it's not yet. It may be a seed. But that's about as far as it goes.
So just to clarify a little bit, the embryo means that the egg has already been fertilized.
Okay, so the zygote.
Right. So it starts out as a zygote, then it multiplies a bunch of times. When it's a blastocyst is actually when they do PGD. Because what they have to do is they have to take a cell out of it. If you take a cell out of a zygote, it's no longer a zygote.
So there's
just a goat. It's got nothing.
We have so many stages today. We have the zygote. The embryo, then the fetus.
Right.
So at which stage do we say we can't destroy?
Right. So indeed, there are a couple of different ways you can look at this. One way to look at it is to say it's very, very early on in the development, and just try to go based on that and figure out where developmentally it becomes more significant. So Talmudically, we had the idea that before 40 days, it doesn't necessarily have the same status as after 40 days. That's one approach. The other approach is to say, if it hasn't yet been implanted in the mother, it's not necessarily called a life. And this is a prominent view. Because after all, if we didn't implant it in the mother, what would happen? Right, it would die. I mean, nothing. It would be frozen, it would die, whatever environment it is. It's for sure not going to evolve. Where it is right now, if you leave it and don't implant it, it will not become a life. It needs a step from us. And therefore, there is a strong view that says, at this stage, don't view it as abortion, because it's just the opposite. It is aborted effectively right now. It needs me to do something in order to make it a life. So there is that side to the argument, absolutely. So what we're left with right now is a basic opposition, which is, we want to prevent the pain of a child born with Tay-Sachs and of the family into whom the child is born. But the method of pain involves potential problems of ethics and law. Whether in terms of IVF, whether in terms of PGD, we have to ask, so which one is going to win? How do you do this? And our particular questions, how do you do it where what you're trying to avoid is a Tay-Sachs case? How do you do it? Where? What you're trying to avoid is, I already have three boys. I'd like to have a baby girl. Is that something that can be recognized within Jewish law as well? Those are the questions that we have to address. I am not going to be presenting every possible source and every possible argument within it. It's a very large topic. I did give you a link in number 7 to a longer class that I taught on genetic screening, where there's more that you can hear on the topic. But let's go with the serious illness question. What choices does a couple have if they have a fear of creating a child with a serious illness and they are already married? They don't have the option now of screening with each other, or they screen. Just the opposite. They did screen and they got married, knowing that, in fact, they are carriers for this genetic disorder. Not that it's guaranteed. Okay, if you remember your Mendelian genetics, right, you know. It's not guaranteed that the child is going to have this disease, but there's a strong possibility. It may be 25%. It may be higher, depending on whether it's dominant or recessive, whether they're both carriers, and so forth. But let's say they know there is a chance that their child will indeed develop Tay-Sachs. What options do they have? Forget halacha, ethics, whatever. Theoretically, what could they do? Yeah.
Well, they have that test for amniocentesis.
So amniocentesis introduces a new option, which I haven't been dealing with here, but you're right. Technically, you can become pregnant, carry the child to a certain point within the pregnancy, and then do a test and see if the child has it. So that is an option, and at that point, you then have the choice of aborting. I'm not going into that here because that's the whole abortion question all over again, but now pushed later on in the pregnancy, and I'm having enough trouble to figure out whether I can abort a pre-embryo. But go back to the classes, to the links on the abortion classes in number 2, and you can hear more material about that there. But what are the options for parents who know that they are carriers? So option number 1 is to adopt. I'm not going to produce biological children. Adoption has a very long pedigree within Judaism. It is honored within Jewish law. Without adoption, you may not have heard of him, but there was somebody really important in Jewish history by the name of Moses. Right? Adoption's a little familiar. We view adoption in Judaism as something that is a wonderful and great thing for people to do. It is extremely valuable and halachically honored. So that's one decision. They can say, okay, so we're going to adopt. Not everybody can adopt either. They may have to decide. They can't adopt and they can't produce biological children. That may be. That's all within option number 1 is to say, we don't want to risk it. So we simply won't have biological children. Hang on. So the second choice. That's one choice. What's your second choice? Let me just state the three choices, because I'm going to end up going too far afield. You have three choices. Choice number 1 is to say, we will say, don't have biological children. Choice number 2 is to say, you know what, we're going to risk it. We'll have children, we won't use IVF, we won't use PGD, and that's the way they did it until recent decades. That's the way we're going to do it as well. The opposite end of the spectrum, right? One end of the spectrum saying, we're going to be ultra cautious and not have children. Other end of the spectrum saying, sorry, we're going to have children and, pray for the best. And then you have the option of saying, the third approach is to say, we are going to use PGD, we're going to use IVF, and, throw in there whatever other techniques you want, but we're talking PGD IVF at this moment. And basically what you're saying is, if you choose option number 1, which is, I'm not going to have biological children, what you're really saying is The halachic concerns of IVF and PGD, right? Concerns for how the seed is produced, concerns for mix-ups in the lab, concerns for aborting the non-implanted fetuses, concern for playing God, whatever you want to call it, whatever your halachic concern is, that is so significant that I will say, I'm not going to have biological children. That's one approach. Second approach is to say, again, all of these concerns of Jewish law and ethics are so important that I'm not going to use PGD, but I am going to have children. And then the third approach is to say, no, the pain issue is so dominant, this fear of what we're going to do to this child and to the family is so strong that we'll go with IVF and PGD in order to try to prevent that. We're going to look at these three options and evaluate each one. The first option, saying I'm not going to have biological children, has its own halachic problem. Right? What is that halachic problem? Pruvu, bear fruit and multiply. Granted that it can be argued one fulfills that with adoption, but if they're not going to adopt, so then the question is, you're trading one mitzvah for another. You're saying, okay, I'm concerned about not violating the law with IVF, PGD, but now I'm not going to bear fruit and multiply, which is the very first command, other than don't eat that fruit, right? It's the very first command that God gives to human beings. And so the question you have to ask yourself really is, are they obligated in producing children? If you have a case in which a couple has been screened and they know that they could produce a child with such an illness, are they in fact obligated to produce children, or are they exempt from the mitzvah? What would you say? I hear a lot of people saying exempt. What's the logic in saying you're exempt? The pain and agony that's involved. We have a principle within Judaism which says that to fulfill an active, well, let me say it differently. There are two kinds of mitzvot. There are commandments and there are prohibitions. Okay? In Hebrew, aseh and lo taaseh. Okay? A prohibition, let's say, don't eat treif, right? That sort of thing. So there, I'm supposed to spend all my money rather than avoid violating a prohibition. So if I'm in the supermarket and, kosher food is going to cost me three times what non-kosher options cost, nonetheless, that's the way it goes. Go vegetarian, it's cheaper. That's one side of things. If you're dealing with prohibitions, you have to spend money to avoid violating a prohibition. However, when you're dealing with a mitzvah aseh, when you're dealing with a commandment, then the rules are different. You don't have to spend all your money in order to be able to fulfill a commandment. So, to go back to a case which was common in Europe, the holiday of Sukkot is coming. In order to get a set of lulav and etrog, etc., you're going to have to spend everything you got. There's no such obligation. What they often did was a community pooled funds, and they would get like one set, and that was what the community would end up using, and they all just shared it. You don't have to spend everything you have in order to be able to fulfill a commandment. So the argument goes regarding the issue of producing children, that if there's a real concern for producing children with such pain, then they're not going to be obligated in producing children, lest they in fact create a situation in which they will be that level of pain. If you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach wrote this. He passed away about 10 years ago now in Israel. But he wrote, I am uncertain regarding one who has a genetic disease and his children will live all their lives in pain, or one who suffers from hemophilia, which passes to males. That's chromosomally linked. May he refrain from fulfilling procreation, marrying a woman who cannot produce children. Is he allowed to say, I know from the beginning that I'm carrying this, I'll marry a woman who, for whatever reason, can't have children, and that way there's no risk. One is not obligated to spend more than one-third or one-fifth of his funds for a mitzvah. There's a debate about the percentages, but there is a cap on what you have to spend. Even if the mitzvah is only available temporarily, so you say, well, you're missing out. This man feels that his pain and that of his children are worth much more than one-third of his assets. So that's one way you can argue it and say, pain is much more than the money you're telling me that is capped. So therefore, I'm not obligated to expose myself to that level of pain in order to have children. But then he goes the other way. He says, or should we say that one should not investigate such circumstances, don't look into such things, and for this we say, as I said in number one, what business do you have in the secrets of the Merciful One? It's none of your business. Now, Rabbi Auerbach passed away. Again, you know, before PGD became this very broad type of practice, and he doesn't give you a ruling on PGD, but he presents the two sides. And in fact, that's the debate. Rabbi Usher Weiss, who I mentioned last week, is the rabbinic authority for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel, has dealt with this as a practical question. And look what he says in source number 9. He says, it appears that if one is exempt from a mitzvah due to his own suffering, even though he has a personal obligation, then how much more so is he exempt when fulfilling the mitzvah would cause unsurpassable pain to others? He says, number one, you're exempt from your own obligation due to the great pain that's involved. That's more than the one-third or one-fifth of your assets. But he says, keep in mind also, it's not about you. You are a factor as a parent. But it's also the child who's going to be created with this. And many times more so when it would cause a life of pain for an unborn child. It appears, according to this, that where there is great concern that the children produced will have defects in their body and mind, and in the natural order of things, their lives will be lives of suffering and indescribable pain, he is exempt from procreation. Why does he add the clause in the natural order of things? That's a very important clause. Why is that there? Because someone might always say, well, you know what? We pray to God. We'll have the child and we'll pray, and God can always work miracles. And he's telling you that's not the way we operate. Yes, God can create miracles. That is 100% true. Nonetheless, you don't operate on that basis and say, we're going to expose ourselves to the risk and God will take care of it. That's not considered an option. So Rabbi Usher Weiss argues that it is reasonable for them to take this option, in fact, of refraining and saying, so we're not going to. So the man who knows that he's carrying this gene that is so dangerous can say, I'm going to marry a woman who is not going to have children, and, you know, maybe they'll adopt, maybe they won't adopt. But that's a legitimate option to take. Stephen, I saw your hand, but I'm just seeing the time as well. So
the percentage of the risk.
Yeah.
If it's a very low percentage or high percentage,
right.
We didn't factor that in.
Right. So I mentioned it briefly. I'm going to come back to it in a little bit, in like a minute or two. The second option. Okay, so that's your first option, right? Your first option is to say, so forget having biological children. Don't mess with IVF and PGD. Just say, look, this way I'm going to avoid creating such a problem. That's one approach. Second approach, saying, you know what? I'm just going to have children naturally. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that you are taking a risk, and again, not just for yourself, but also for the child. Can you make an argument in favor of saying, go for it? Allowing natural procreation, knowing that you could produce such children.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Many handicapped children that have disabilities, that are comfortable, that are living very productive lives.
Right. So one argument is to say, look at what it is that you are concerned for, and I deliberately stated at the outset, I don't know if you were here yet, that I'm not mentioning specific conditions other than the Tay-Sachs case that I gave. In the Tay-Sachs case, we don't have options for them. They're not going to survive beyond 3, 4, or 5 years old, and it's going to be pain until they reach that point. So it's one thing to say, well, deal with it. It's another thing to say some things can't really be dealt with. And again, it's going to vary based on the person. So that's one key point. But make an argument on behalf of saying then you just take the risk. You can make the argument. There is such a valid argument. Logically. Yeah?
They may not produce children that have...
Right. Number one, you don't know that you're actually going to have such a child. Even if the risk is 25%, right, that's 1 in 4. That's one argument. Second, though, this is a fascinating question, which we are not going to answer here, but is it truly better, you know, to never have been born at all? Because keep in mind what you're doing with PGD. You're not choosing between having this child with a disease or the same child without the disease. When you do PGD, you're aborting the child who would have had the disease and saying, I'm going to implant a different one. So creating such a child, you can argue, is not really harming the child because the alternative is the child doesn't exist at all. Now, that is a fraught question. Is it really better to be born into this world in a life of pain as opposed to not existing at all? The church would say yes, right? The church's argument is if you're once there's conception, then you're saved and so on and so forth and the next world. Judaism doesn't really have that precedent, number one. Number two, we actually have a Talmudic passage with a great debate as to whether a person is better off never having been created at all. And the winning position is better not to have been created. Again, there's a lot more to discuss with that. But you should know, it's not simple and straightforward, but the argument can be that creating such a child is better than the child never being born, and therefore proceed with this, having children naturally, and you could find support for it in the position of Rabbi Auerbach, which we read in source number 8, where he said you have the option of refraining from procreation, potentially, but he didn't say you're obligated to. And he's not dealing with a PGD case. He's before that. So the argument can be made, go ahead and have children naturally. Rabbi Aryeh Katz wrote an article in a popular Israeli journal called Tchumin, in which he said, absolutely not. He said, you would be obligated to go with the IVF PGD approach. You would not be allowed to produce children naturally. And he says, take a look at source number 10. This goes back to your question, Stephen, about risk levels. He says, today, when one could fulfill procreation via IVF and PGD, there is no room to follow the natural course and take the risk of producing ill children. In truth, there is room to argue that since of these severe genetic diseases, some of these severe genetic diseases are conveyed on a recessive gene, and the risk of an ill child is only 25%, he says only, then in the majority of cases, the child will be healthy and we should follow the majority. You can make that argument. And even though we don't follow the majority when saving lives, we usually go as far as we have to go. And we don't say, well, the majority of people will be fine. I don't need to do anything about it. We don't usually do that. In these cases, we are generally not speaking of saving lives. He presents the counter argument. He says, you might argue 25% is not a high level of risk. And you may additionally argue that that you're talking about someone whose life is not in danger. They'll survive to a certain point, but he says, I don't agree. In my humble opinion, it appears we should follow popular opinion regarding level and severity of risk, which is to say, if someone told you, here's a piece of food, you can eat this, there's a 1 in 4 chance that it's fatal, I would hope no one in this room would take that risk. So he makes the argument that you can't say, well, 25% is a minority. No one takes risks at that level. Yes, I'm, tightrope walkers. But most of the world does not take such risks. I'm just looking at the time, and I think I need to proceed here. But his argument is that, no, it's not allowed. He does not believe that you would be allowed to proceed without IVF and PGD in such a case. He thinks that it's obligatory. Others disagree and say, no, they could see the justice justification for taking that risk. Last of the three options. Saying the pain involved in producing a child with X condition, Tay-Sachs, whatever we're talking about, is sufficient that, combined with the fact that this is a pre-embryo, it hasn't been implanted yet, you'd be justified in taking the, overriding the halachic concerns of PGD and IVF and taking that route instead. You follow? That's the third argument, is it's only a pre-embryo, it hasn't been implanted, and there's such pain involved, so go ahead and do the PGD IVF route. That's the argument. Others, you know, some disagree. Rabbi J. David Bleich, in source number 11, says absolutely not. He doesn't buy the whole argument that a pre-embryo hasn't been implanted yet. He says, I don't care, it's still a pre-embryo. In number 11, he is responding to a letter from a doctor in the journal Tradition. He says, Dr. Reisner's point with regard to a distinction between in utero and ex utero gestation, I find to be confusing. He concedes that a fetus conceived ex utero and brought to term in an incubator, right, which isn't yet possible, but if you could do it. You can't yet go with the entire pregnancy in an incubator. That doesn't exist. In a few decades it will, but not yet. But he says, if hypothetically you had such a fetus brought to term, it would be a human being for all purposes of halakha. Right? No one would say it's not a human being. If it is conceded that in utero conception is not a necessary condition of humanhood, I fail to understand why obligations vis-a-vis an ex utero fetus should be any different from obligations vis-a-vis an in utero fetus. He does not believe that the fact that it hasn't been implanted yet makes a difference. And so he would argue against the IVF PGD approach. But again, many halachic authorities disagree. They say abortion is not called murder. They make that argument. And go back to our questions about what exactly it is. If it's wounding, destroying the pre-embryo outside of the mother doesn't wound the mother at all. And it can be argued it's not called wounding the pre-embryo either, because wounding has a definition to it. There's a body and has a limb and the limb got cut off, or you cause something to bleed. In this case, there's no wounding. It's not a body yet. It's just a couple of cells. You know, 8 cells, 16 cells, depending on which stage it's already divided. So the argument is to be more lenient on that front, and therefore, indeed, many authorities in Jewish law will allow PGD in cases where both mates are carriers for a recessive gene for the illness, or where one mate carries a dominant gene for the illness. So in other words, what it really means, for those who aren't up on the genetics, what we're saying is, if there is a chance that the child could develop the actual disease, they're willing to approve PGD. If, however, the child cannot develop the disease, at most the child will just be a carrier, then they say we won't go that route. Because you're not preventing the child from developing the disease. The child isn't going to develop the disease anyway. Right? So where what we're saying is, it's carried on the genes of the mother and the father. And one of them is a carrier. And the other one is not. So yeah, the child may be a carrier, but there's no way that the child is actually going to develop the disease. Take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, who I mentioned earlier. When there is meaningful concern for a severe genetic disease, such as where both mates are carriers of a recessive gene like Tay-Sachs, or one of the mates is a carrier of a dominant gene like Huntington's disease, they may use PGD, meaning for the two mates to engage in IVF, to check whether the eggs or the fertilized eggs are afflicted with the disease, and to destroy eggs which are determined to be affected, and to use only the healthy eggs, meaning those which do not carry the gene for the disease. One must be very careful not to switch the sperm and egg, to appoint a special supervisor to oversee what we already talked about before. And in the footnote, he credits some very prominent authorities in Jewish law who supported this position. He did note along the way, if you read carefully, you notice he also mentioned testing the egg before the egg is fertilized. And that's something that is still in the works as a procedure, but it may avoid certain problems if you can do that before it's even fertilized. However, in number 13, he says, when you're dealing with a recessive gene for the disease and only one mate carries it, then the only way you could use PGD would be if there were some other reason why they were using IVF anyway, such as they couldn't produce children without it. So then he says, all right, then you're doing IVF anyway, then you can do it. But otherwise not, because again, you're not preventing an illness. So what this means is, overall, that you could make the argument to opt out of having biological children. You can make the argument for IVF PGD where there is a concern that the child may have such a terrible illness. We have skirted the question of which illnesses qualify. And according to some, you can make the argument of having children naturally. Others disagree and say that's not fair to the child. You don't have the right to take that that risk. Now, the last point that I had mentioned in the beginning was the issue of choosing gender. I'm going to do this in just a minute. There are cases in which there's a medical benefit in producing a female. If you remember your genetics, you know that the male has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. A female has two X chromosomes, one inherited from the sperm, one inherited from the egg. What that means is this. If there is a disease that is only found on the X chromosome, that's where the gene is, and the male knows, well, the parents know that if they have a boy, then that boy is getting the X for sure from the mother, and the Y chromosome from the father. And they know that the mother is a carrier of the illness, right? So you have a bunch of ifs. But if they know the mother carries the illness and it's an X-linked disease, they may choose to have a female. Because if you have a male, then there's a chance, depending on which X chromosome the child gets, but there's a 50-50 chance that the child is going to actually develop the disease. So there are medical reasons to go with a female as opposed to a male. That's worth noting. But let's say that's not why you're choosing a particular gender. Let's say it's because I have a boy and I'd like to now have a girl as well. I want to fulfill the biblical mitzvah of procreation, which the Talmud states is fulfilled when you have a boy and a girl. So I want it for that reason. Or because I want balance within the family. Sorry? Was that a surprise?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, the Talmudic explanation of pruvu, the mitzvah of procreation, is to have a girl and a boy, and that's how you fulfill the mitzvah. Somebody says, I want to be able to fulfill the mitzvah. Or just they want family balance. So are you allowed to do it for this purpose? So the idea of manipulating gender is actually not foreign to Judaism. Way before there were modern technologies, the Talmud talked about methods of trying to make sure your child will be of a particular gender. If you do this, it'll be a boy. If you do this, it'll be a girl. Yes, those methods are non-scientific. Yes, they were very popular in the ancient world. Yes, if you try them, you know, who knows what comes out. But the point is, no one in the Talmudic discussion stops them and says, hey, wait a minute, you're playing God. They were fine with the concept of trying to produce a child of a particular gender. However, when you're dealing with IVF and PGD, where we've said that there are halachic problems in engaging in this, like the disposal of the embryos you're not planning on implanting, so there's a stronger opposition, because the justification of I want a particular gender is just not as strong. Plus you have this slippery slope concern of what else are you going to permit. Now, as it happens, you saw sources 14 and 15. The U.S., it is 100% legal. In Canada, it appears to be against the law. It's a very interesting thing when you really think about what's going on in Canadian law. Rabbi Ziering, my friend who was with us last year, you may see him in the building because he's actually visiting now, but he made the point to me that the penalties are very high for violating the Assisted Human Reproduction Act. Meaning, if you go ahead with PGD and you choose a particular embryo because of its gender and you destroy the other ones, there's a very high penalty. However, one can abort without having to provide any justification, and there's no penalty at all. Abort a pre-embryo, right? Abort a pre-embryo for gender, and there are very high penalties. Abort a 7-month child without an explanation, and you're not facing those penalties. Someone has to discuss this at some point, but it's not going to be me. You can't, is that true? You have to go through a committee. Okay, then I stand corrected, because I'm sorry, I'm not coming from... Okay, hang on, everyone hears the correction, I hope. At what point is the committee required?
At the 5th month.
At the 5th month. Okay, so the 3-monther you are able to, but not the pre-embryo. Okay. You understand why I am confused.
Yeah.
If I decided with a pre-embryo that I wanted to have a girl, right? I aborted a pre-embryo boy because I wanted to have a girl. I have penalties. I abort at 3 months. They tell me with the ultrasound that it's going to be that it's going to be a boy, and I abort for that. No penalty. You see my problem. There's a lot to be said about that. But in any case, if you look at number 16, right, Dr. Avram Steinberg makes the point that he is against the idea of using it to choose the gender in general. Generally, one may not encourage it. And even where they only have children from one gender. However, there's much more in the literature, I just didn't bring it here on the page, that suggests once you reach a certain threshold, you have 4 boys and you want a girl, 5 boys and you want a girl, then there is indeed, according to halakhic authorities, room to discuss saying that IVF and PGD may well be appropriate to be able to have a child of the other gender. There's more to be said about it. Again, as I said in the beginning, I'm just presenting the issues and some sources. There's a lot more, but hopefully what we brought out of this today in terms of our look at the Jew of the future is this question of, number one, how I view the status of a non-implanted embryo, and whatever I'm going to do with this embryo is going to depend on how I understand its status, and the ethical questions that are facing us, some of which are live already and some of which will be in the next years, is going to be what really justifies screening? What kind of decisions are people entitled to make when they choose the type of child that they're going to have? God willing, next week we take it to an entirely different topic, the topic of must an artificial intelligence observe Shabbat, the robot Shabbat. See you next week.